Welcome to SCOTUSCast, the Clean Water Act Approved Jurisdictional Determinations and Judicial Review Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 30th, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in United States Army Corps of Engineers v. Hawks Co. Inc. Hawks Co. applied to the Army Corps of Engineers for a Clean Water Act permit to begin extracting peat from wetlands in northern Minnesota it was preparing to purchase. After attempting to discourage the purchase and initiating various administrative processes, the Corps ultimately issued an approved jurisdictional determination, asserting that the wetland contained waters of the United States, thereby creating a substantial barrier to development by Hawks. Hawks files suit in federal district court to challenge the approved JD, arguing that it conflicted with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. The district court dismissed the suit on the grounds that the approved JD was not a final agency action as defined by the Administrative Procedure Act, and therefore not yet subject to judicial review. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit reversed that judgment and remanded the case, holding that an approved JD did constitute final agency action ripe for judicial review. The question before the Supreme Court is whether the United States Army Corps of Engineers' determination that the property at issue contains waters of the United States protected by the Clean Water Act constitutes final agency action for which there is no other adequate remedy in a court. It is therefore subject to judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. To discuss the case, we have Mark Miller, who is Managing Attorney, Atlantic Center, Pacific Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Miller.
So I'll start with some background on the case for those of you who don't know about it. U.S. Army Corps versus Hawks, Army Corps of Engineers versus Hawks, deals with a company, Hawks Company, that mines for peat or farms for peat. Peat is a soil amendment that is used often for making grass for football fields or golf courses. It's very rich, fen is the term, and rich fen. And so Hawks Company has been doing this for years up in Minnesota. And they have a number of sites where they mine for this peat. And peat, of course, is a wetland. And the question in this case is whether their wetland where they mine for the peat is federal, is subject to federal jurisdiction. So is there any sort of connection between the property they want to use for their peat mining and federal waters? As many of you know, that decision really comes out of the question as to whether their property is going to be jurisdictional to the Army Corps of Engineers and ultimately EPA flows from Rapanos. And Pacific Legal Foundation litigated Rapanos a decade ago, and the same lawyer who argued Rapanos was first chair and lead counsel today on behalf of Hawks Company. So The property at issue in this case is about 550 acres, and the Corps of Engineers came in after Hawks Company asked for a permit to mine for peat, and the Corps of Engineers came in and started making noises that suggested they were never going to give a permit to Hawks Company to mine this land for the peat. So Hawks Company went ahead and asked for a jurisdictional determination. They said, please let us know whether – well, first they asked for a preliminary jurisdictional determination. Please let us know what's your general opinion on whether there's going to be waters of the United States on this property. And the government, the Corps, said, helpfully, of course, as the government will do, yes, we think there is going to be some waters of the United States, some federal wetlands subject to our jurisdiction on this property. And so – their logic didn't really hold there. The premise of the argument at that point was that it fit the Scalia plurality from Rapanos that said there was a continuous surface water connection between the Hawks property at issue and the Red River of the North in Minnesota. And so this continuous surface connection had to somehow connect up this land over 120 miles away with the interstate water, Red River of the North. So when Hawks challenged that preliminary JD finding, the Corps changed course, and the Corps, on its full approved jurisdictional determination, and a jurisdictional determination is where the government tells you as a landowner whether they think we have jurisdiction over your property when the federal government does that. And arguably, the government would say it's a step in the permitting process, but we would say it's really the beginning and end of the permitting process, because if you don't agree with them, you're kind of stuck. You're going to have to go forward into getting the permit. And if you do agree, well, then you knew you had to get a permit anyway. But once you're told whether that property is federal wetlands, you have no good choices. You either do nothing, or you go through a permitting process that, as I mentioned earlier, the government had already said, had already implied they were never going to get. Or you go ahead and just discharge, use the soil as they intended to, use the wetlands as they intended to, and risk a compliance action or an enforcement order or being sued to the tune of a criminal prosecution or heavy civil prosecution. So they asked for a full approved jurisdictional determination, which means there's further analysis by the Corps, and the Corps does it. And like I said, they switch out of the Scalia plurality continuous surface connection to, and again in Rapanos, to the Kennedy test, which was that there's a significant nexus between their property and the Red River of the North 120 miles away. And this is where it gets interesting for the Corps of Engineers, and where you would think the Corps of Engineers would have known better than to take this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, because when they say there's a significant nexus under the regs, our client had the right to take an administrative appeal. And they took that administrative appeal. And so the left hand says there's a significant nexus on this property. This is federal wetlands. There's a significant nexus between this property and the Red River of the North, 120 miles away. But the right hand says, the appellate official internally at the administrative, in the Corps of Engineers, says, no, there is no significant nexus. You've shown no significant nexus. Go back to the drawing board. So the left hand takes the case back after having been rejected by another official in the Corps. And instead of trying to make a better job out of it and really show, which in fact we would posit they can't show, but they don't even try to bring up evidence, develop evidence to make their case. They just say, no, we disagree with you, internal right hand of the Army Corps of Engineers. We really do think there's a significant nexus here. We don't care that you don't think so. And they tell our clients, you've got to get a permit, and you're going to have to dance to our tune, and we may never even give you that permit. Well, that's where the Hawks Company says, well, okay, we've been doing this now for a couple of years, this dance, and you've made it clear to us you're never going to give us a permit. You're now telling us you want us to do all sorts of hydrological testing to get that permit to the tune of around $100,000 and $150,000. We disagree with you. We agree with your right hand, your administrative official internally, who said there are no wetlands here. And so we want to take you to court and argue that on the Administrative Procedure Act, this was the final decision, and so under 704, we have a right to challenge you in court to a district judge. The Corps has fought that tooth and nail ever since. The district judge agreed with the Corps and relied on a case out of the Ninth Circuit. This is in the Eighth Circuit's jurisdiction up there in Minnesota. And the precedent, this case called Fairbanks, that Pacific Legal Foundation had argued back in 2009, and the Ninth Circuit had rejected the idea that a jurisdictional determination found wetlands was an appealable final decision. In the meantime, we then won the Sackett case. And so for those of you who are environmental lawyers and specialize in wetlands, you know the Sackett case was a case where we had a husband and wife who owned a half-acre lot in Priest Lake, Idaho, and they wanted to develop their lot, and in fact they started moving the dirt, and the EPA came in and said, no, this is wetlands, even though there are no wetlands, and you are now going to be fined to the tune of $37,500 a day unless you put this property back where it was before you started cleaning it up, before you started moving the dirt. And at that point, no court had ever said someone in that position facing $37,000 fine a day, $37,000 in fines a day, it said no one could challenge that in court. But the Sacketts took it, and they lost in the district court. They lost in the they lost in the district court, they lost in the Circuit Court of Appeals, and then Pacific Legal got involved at the U.S. Supreme Court, and back in 2012, Damian Schiff, another Pacific Legal lawyer, won that case. The court said 9-0 that this administrative compliance order was appealable, even though there's nothing by Congress that said it would be appealable, because it's really a creature of the EPA's own making. So that decision, we argued in this case, in Hawk's company, meant that the Fairbanks decision that the Ninth Circuit had reached was no longer good law. And in the meantime, there is a companion case, not exactly a companion case, but the same issue going on in the Fifth Circuit. That's a case called Bell Company that's now pending at the Supreme Court on hold, pending Hawks. In Bell Company, the Fifth Circuit agreed with the Fairbanks Court in the Ninth Circuit and said JDs are not reviewable, and that they didn't think those justices didn't, those judges did not think SACA compelled a different result. We took a petition for writ of cert of that decision, and like I said, it's on hold. And then the Eighth Circuit rules in Hawks in our favor. Reid Hopper argued that case, the same lawyer who argued at the Supreme Court of the United States. He argued to the Eighth Circuit, and Judge Loken, writing for the majority, said that a JD puts a landowner in a no-win proposition. It's clearly a final order. So under the Bennett versus Speer final appealable order decision in line of cases, it's definitely final, and it sets rights, and it sets obligations for the landowner, and it also has legal consequence for the landowner. Judge Kelly, who some of you may have seen, Judge Jane Kelly was in the hopper being discussed as the potential President Obama nominee for a Supreme Court of the United States. Judge Kelly wrote a concurrence where she said she thought it was a close case, but she thought the fact that the Clean Water Act was so difficult to understand, so difficult to interpret, that you needed to spend $100,000 in experts to determine whether the Clean Water Act even applied, made this a situation so like the SACA case that she agreed with the majority with the decision, the unanimous decision, that a jurisdictional determination would be reviewable. So that's what gets us to the Supreme Court of the United States. And so today, the government took the petition for writ of cert here, and so the government went first. And for the Solicitor General, we had Malcolm Stewart. And just coincidentally, Malcolm Stewart was the same attorney who had argued Sackett. And so he was very familiar with the issues, and he had a hot bench and, a very interesting series of questions that would lead you to believe that at a minimum four, and hopefully a majority of the court, thinks that agrees with the Eighth Circuit that a jurisdictional determination leaves a property owner like Hawks Company in a no-win situation such that they should be able to go to court because it is a final decision that has legal consequence. And so what I want to do now is not exactly give you a play-by-play, but just sort of give you an inside the courthouse, inside the courtroom view of how it went. So from the get-go, the Justice Alito started the questioning by focusing on the idea as to whether a jurisdictional determination was binding. And the question as to whether it's binding implies whether it's binding on both the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA, because late in the process, in the reply brief, in fact, the Solicitor General, and on behalf of the Corps, took the position that a jurisdictional determination would not be binding. And in fact, that the EPA could go in a completely different direction and say this is not waters of the United States. We had hoped that the justices would see through that because it was effectively a change of position. And in fact, there is a memorandum of understanding between the two agencies that says they are binding. And so in some ways, Justice Alito and then Chief Justice Roberts following up on him stole some of our best punches, because immediately – Justice Alito says, is it binding? And Mr. Stewart for the government says, no, it's not binding under this MOU. And he gets into what is a fairly arcane argument about a memorandum of understanding and what it means. And Chief Justice Roberts shut him down on that. The government's position was that this MOU had to only deal with special circumstances. And they simply started reading this memorandum of understanding from 1989. And it was clear that both Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts thought the government was was effectively misrepresenting. I don't want to be quoted on that, but if they made it clear that this MOU said that jurisdictional determinations are binding. It even used that very language, quote unquote, they are binding. And then it addressed special cases, but that there was no question. It facially said cases like this, a JD is binding. From there, the question got interesting because this case really did not break down on ideological lines. Justice Sotomayor actually started asking the next series of questions, and she wanted to know, if it's not binding, then, Mr. Stewart, wouldn't you have some examples of where the EPA went behind a jurisdictional determination that the Corps had issued? And, in fact, Mr. Stewart had to say, no, I really don't have any examples. I don't know, quote-unquote, he wrote, quote-unquote, he said, I don't know if the EPA ever has. And, again, so he's really having to concede the first prong of Bennett, that it's final and has legal consequences, because if it's binding, that's really the second prong as well. Chief Justice Roberts followed up on that, a series of questions, and then again, showing this case was not a case that broke down on ideological lines, you had Justice Ginsburg, who teased out the idea that the JD decision is made, and really that is the whole ball of wax, yet the property owner now has to go through the, as she said, quote unquote, very arduous and expensive process of trying to get the permit. The government tried to point to really the key case it relied on in its initial brief, which was FTC versus Standard Oil, but Justice Breyer at that point stepped in. And Justice Breyer, if you are a specialist in this area of the law, administrative law, then you probably can predict what I would say. Justice Breyer said that I joined the Bennett versus Speer opinion, which was written by Scalia. I joined that because I felt it was just teasing out the Abbott Labs test that you need a final decision from which legal consequences flow. And Bennett was just simply teasing out Abbott Labs. And then he specifically mentioned a case that really was our number one case, the frozen food case from, I think it's 56. Frozen food, we believe, is effectively on all fours with our case, or our case is on all fours with frozen food. And in fact, Justice Breyer said, as far as he was concerned, it was effectively QED, that this was such a slam dunk. He even teased out that there was a dissent in frozen food by Justice Harlan, and that Harlan said, I agree with the majority, but effectively I think you need a case where an agency is actually applying a rule, and he didn't have that in frozen food. That's why he dissented. Well, our case is that dissent. So the majority in frozen food would have agreed with Harlan, but they went further. Well, here our case is what Harlan wanted. So effectively our case matches frozen food, and Breyer agreed. And frankly, if you're an appellate lawyer, after you heard that, it might have gone through your mind that maybe I should just get up and say, if there are no questions, I'm going to sit down, because it was pretty clear at that point between Sotomayor's questions, Breyer's questions, Alito's questions, Roberts' questions, and then effectively even Justice Ginsburg's questions, that you were pretty sure you had a majority here, but of course that wasn't going to happen. What else? What are other high points I could hit? I should get at what Justice Kagan was asking about. Justice Kagan did probably as good a job as has been made for the government to try and tease out what the government's counter would be. She did that mostly during the questioning of Reid Hopper, my colleague at PLF. And her point she tried to make is that a jurisdictional determination, in her estimation, is hardly different from an advisory letter that agencies give advisory letters to parties, whether it's the FCC, the FTC, or what have you, and regulated parties like the advice. The counter to that would be, of course, that this is a lot more than just a letter. And yes, there is case law to support the government if this was a letter. But in fact, as Justice Breyer pointed out, and effectively some of the oral argument was a back and forth between Kagan and Justice Breyer more than even the attorneys on the days. Breyer's point was, his response to the argument that this is no different than an advisory letter is that there's an entire CFR section dedicated to this jurisdictional determination process, the preliminary jurisdictional determination, then the affirmative jurisdictional determination, the fact you can take an administrative appeal. This is not an advisory letter. There's a lot more going on here. Justice Kennedy followed up on Kagan's point that this is really important. This is really a high point that I would recommend anyone who practices in this area consider. And if you look at the transcript, I think the transcript is already available. I haven't read it yet. But Justice Kennedy said, and following up Justice Kagan, is that the Clean Water Act, he said, is quite vague. And I don't know if he said perhaps, but he basically said perhaps unconstitutional. And you really heard almost a gasp from the courtroom when he said that, because he basically seemed to be inviting some challenges along those lines. Malcolm Stewart for the government rejected that. He said, actually, no, the Clean Water Act usually is quite clear. There are times when it's hard, but Congress designed the statute and they expect you to go through the permitting process. Back and forth. Really, if we then switch over to Mr. Hopper representing Hawks Company, these questions really went to, what are the legal consequences? And really, isn't this just a salutary piece of advice, a helpful piece of advice that the government is giving, that the Corps is giving this landowner? And so the landowner should be thankful. I should note here as a little footnote that we had 16 amicus briefs on behalf of almost 60 different parties, 29 different states, who all don't find the process to be helpful. You had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You had, like I said, 29 states. You had the NFIB on behalf of small businesses. So you got big businesses. You pretty much have everyone who runs the gamut who would, in theory, fit into this Kagan idea that this is helpful, all saying, no, we don't think this is helpful at all. Ultimately, Kagan appeared to be almost alone. I think it's possible that Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor might look for a narrow win. And I could be wrong. I'm just speculating based on what I saw in the oral argument. But, we felt pretty good based on the questioning that, like I said at the beginning of the call, that four of the justices certainly saw it closer to the way Hawks sees it, and we're optimistic about three of the other four.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.